Hi, welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. It is Friday, April 5th, and I'm Jessica Steinberg. I'm speaking today with political correspondent Tal Schneider and Arab Affairs reporter Luca Pacchiani. Hi, good morning to you both.
Good morning, Jessica.
Good morning. Hi.
Hi there. It is day 182 of the war. Hostage negotiations are reportedly being held this weekend in Cairo with the U.S. CIA director, his Egyptian-Israeli counterparts, and the Qatari prime minister. Meanwhile, late last night, Israel announced that it will open a port and crossings for getting aid into Gaza following a tense conversation between Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and U.S. President Joe Biden. We'll talk more about that in a bit. Israelis also grew very nervous about a potential Iranian response to Israel's alleged assassination of Iran's top commander in Syria, alongside protests against Israel that have ramped up in next-door neighbor Jordan. We'll talk about that, as well as where Israel is 6 months after October 7th, and a Palestinian activist in the U.S. who appears to be leading a one-man campaign. All of that in today's podcast. Okay, Tal, let's talk about the latest. The cabinet made a decision late last night regarding Gaza and humanitarian aid that followed this phone call between Biden and Netanyahu. Of course, that follows the tragic killing of 7 humanitarian aid workers in Gaza. Talk us through it, the cabinet decision, what that all really means on the ground here.
Right. So as you said, very late last night, Israel's wide cabinet, not just the small war cabinet, but the one that includes the entire people coming from, the extreme right. They sat together and they said that they will allow Benny Gantz and Eisenkot and Netanyahu to make those decisions with respect to the change of policy with respect to the humanitarian aid. Now, you have to understand the international community and specifically the United States been asking Israel to change its policy for 6 months now. I mean, day and night, Israel got requests from Biden and Blinken and Lloyd Austin calling them and saying, let more food in. And, here in Israel, the people were very busy with our own grief and we're not noticing the entire world insistence on that. And there's a huge criticism out there, but the Israeli public thought, as long as we have hostages there, why are we allowing aid in? But it doesn't work like that in the international community. And last night, the cabinet finally, after so many months of pressure, said they will open up another crossing in the northern part. This is Erez Crossing. Erez Crossing was severely damaged during the massacre on October 7th. Many soldiers were killed there, but also the entire building, the entire crossing was ruined and damaged, and they needed to fix that. Also, they will open up Ashdod port, meaning the convoys will come not just from the Egyptian side, from El Arish, they will also come from the Israeli side, meaning all of those ships with containers can come to 2 different locations and then be brought in through Erez or other crossings. This will allow Israel to make sure that more humanitarian aid is, this is food, medicines, and more will enter. Now, you have to understand, it is coming only after this major pressure and very tough conversation between Biden and Netanyahu. Biden actually said to Netanyahu on Thursday evening, he said to him, if we don't see immediate change, there will be a change in U.S. policy towards Israel, meaning we'll not supply you with ammunition and more. There was only this pressure that brought Netanyahu to move forward with that. So this is the main story. And obviously, this is today is the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan, where Muslims all around the world go to pray. And there is huge concerns in Israel for that this last day of the holiday will be taken into an attack on Israel. Specifically, as you mentioned, the fear is coming from the northern area. Some intelligence in Israel suggests that the Iranian may step up their game and shoot into Israel from Iranian territory. Up until now, we were under Iranians' missiles coming from Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, and even once from Iraq. Now they think that the Iranian will even change course and do it from their own territory, something that they didn't do for years. So they thought maybe the last Friday is the signal for them to do something. For that reason, there was some sort of a panic yesterday.
People were, you know, out buying generators and stocking up on food. And there was a sense of panic and a sense of tension. There was also people poking fun at themselves. Like there was this meme that was going around of an Israeli Wolt food delivery guy stuck in the dunes of Egypt because GPS was turned off in the center in Tel Aviv. But of course, there's significant seriousness to the situation, correct?
Right. As you said, there were preparations made. One of the preparations was turning off GPS services all around the country, which meant no one could navigate. And, you know, it was weird. But and then traffic jams all around the country. But also, you know, Israel's chief intelligence implied that the worst of this war is yet to come, and for that reason people panicked. I think then on late afternoon, IDF spokesman went to the podium, took to the podium and said, you know, we don't know what's coming, but you know, you have to relax because we have the air defense system that will protect us, and we don't see any changes in this protection. But obviously military is on higher alert. Many soldiers stayed in on bases, and you know, they called in some reserve duty with respect to air defense systems. So there was some sort of preparation done last night. And now this is Friday. We just wait and see today to see what's going on.
Okay, thanks for that, Tal. Luca, turning to you and to our other neighbor, to Jordan, you wrote about this uptick in daily protests over the course of 10, 11 days in Jordan as people demand an end to the peace treaty with Israel. And is that real? Are those Hamas proxies? What's your sense in researching and writing this piece?
You're right. It's been 12 nights of daily protests in Jordan and various cities in Jordan, mainly concentrated in Amman around the Israeli embassy, which has been evacuated months ago anyway. So the protest started on March 24, when there was a false report in Al Jazeera that Israeli soldiers had raped Palestinian women at Shifa Hospital in Gaza. Al Jazeera retracted that report later, but it was too late for the Jordanian street. It caused a massive outburst of protests, and they haven't stopped in spite of a wave of arrest by the Jordanian regime. What's interesting and ironic is that the Jordanian regime has been one of the most vocal critics of Israel since the start of the war. You know, Queen Rania had some controversial statements, including saying that the humanitarian crisis in Gaza had been deliberate. Jordan has set up field hospitals in Gaza that they've done airdrops of humanitarian aid and things like that, but for the population is not enough. So while a lot of it is probably spontaneous, I mean, half of the Jordanian population is of Palestinian origin after all. Hamas has known that Jordan was fertile ground since the beginning. So in November, its military spokesman Abu Obeida actually had a statement addressing the people of Jordan, inciting them to basically, yeah, violence against Israel, to attack the embassy, things like that, storm over the border with Israel. And experts that I've spoken with agree that the hidden hand of Hamas is still behind these protests. Just because, like, the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the umbrella movement of which Hamas is part, is very strong in Jordan. They have a very strong grip over the population, and the Jordanian regime has also given them a free hand to proselytize in the country. And so there's probably a lot of incitement coming from Hamas, both directly from speeches by its leaders and on the ground.
Is there any sense from the security establishment here that there's a real threat coming from Jordan? And what has the Jordanian government response been?
So the Jordanian government has portrayed this as a group of troublemakers and vandals, basically torching cars and things like that. They really downplay it in the Jordanian press, which is mostly affiliated with the regime. They're probably not going to be heavy-handed in the repression. This is not Syria. It's not Egypt. They're probably going to wait for it to, you know, wind down. There has been speculations that Iran is behind this, just because, you know, there's a whole crescent of Iranian influence in the region, extending from Iraq to Syria and Lebanon, and Jordan is probably like the missing piece in the puzzle. I'm not sure how much of these reports are credible. It would make sense in a way, but I'm not sure that Iranian presence in Jordan is that strong. There's no Shiite minority there. And after all, it's a very stable country. It's a very stable regime that has endured a massive wave of refugees from Iraq, Syria, Palestinians as well. And it's never been destabilized. So we can be certain that this is not going to really be a threat for us. The Jordanian regime is concerned about other things. There's massive smuggling of weapons from Jordan into the West Bank. There's occasionally drones that are aimed at Israel and fall in Jordanian territory. I think it happened a couple of days ago. So this is what the Jordanian regime is mostly concerned about. Definitely not the protests for now.
All right. Thanks for that, Luca. We're going to take a quick break. When we're back, we'll talk to Tal about 6 months and since October 7th and what that means right now. So, Tal, it is very tough to believe. It has been 6 months since October 7th. It's a moment that's being discussed and marked, certainly by the hostage families. What does it mean in terms of the war? What does it mean in terms of our politics?
Right. We are actually preparing all of those, you know, covering pieces for this coming Sunday for, you know, telling our readers what took place here for 6 months. And I was looking at the, you know, the diplomatic aspects, how Israel's relationship have crashed all around the world. I mean, we had the biggest support on October 7th and the weeks following with, you know, US presidents coming here and the entire world leaders visiting our country and supporting and the atrocities. And people were talking about the torch and the rapes and things that took place, the entire region of Israel that was conquered for almost, you know, a day. And we lost so many lives. I mean, the biggest loss of life event in Israel since the beginning of the country. We never had a war like that. And, you know, through time, you can see how Israel became secluded and closed within itself, mourning our deaths, but not listening to whatever is being, you know, spoken to us from the entire world leaders with respect to humanitarian aid and with respect to the problems that this war brings on. And mostly, I think, from the Israeli side, zero willingness to prepare something for the day after. I mean, you know, U.S. president said on the first call to Netanyahu, and I went back and looked at it, on October 8th, on the first call, President Biden said to Netanyahu, you know, make a plan for the day after. Think what you want to do there. Think how things should end, even before the troops entered into Gaza territory. And they were not listening here. And, you know, seeing it, you know, on a hindsight, it's very sad because right now, obviously, all the problems that were pointed at from day one are here with us and we have no solution. So It is too soon to, you know, to look at this event from the inside. I think these atrocities and massacre will be with us for many, many years to come. And, you know, Israel society is not even halfway to healing as long as we have hostages in. But when you see the deterioration of the relationship, when it comes to the point 6 months later, when the American president says, unless you enter humanitarian aid quickly, I will change policy towards Israel. This is very sad. And I think one of the reasons for that, and I will say it just in one sentence, one of the things that we recognize through those 6 months is that, you know, some politicians are taking internal political issues and sort of translating them into foreign affairs strategy. And they're not realizing that you cannot use this leverage or the way you want to convince your inner crowds, you cannot turn that into foreign affairs policy. Mm-hmm. And that's what it feels like. There is a huge gap between the way they explain or pursue things to the Israeli public and to the way the world is working. So that's a problem, and there is not a solution here. And I'm just pointing out, you know, to this issue.
Right. It actually reminds me of I'm also working on a 6-month piece about the hostage families and about some who have become very critical of Netanyahu, even though they might have been Netanyahu voters at one point. And one brother of a hostage said to me, "We went to the rallies for many, many months and weeks, and now we're not going to them. We're going to the protests. We're going to the anti-government protests because we feel that's the only choice that we have." And it also shows that switch, and that the switch that some people have made because they feel that there is this vacuum and that things aren't happening the way that they thought or think that they should take place. Sort of an interesting point. Okay, thanks for that, Tal. Luca, I'm going to talk to you for the last item on today's podcast. Fascinating piece about one Palestinian activist, lives in the States, and he talks very succinctly and clearly about Hamas's, as he says, awful leadership. Tell us about him.
Yeah, well, he's very critical of all of the Palestinian leadership in general.
Right, right.
Yeah. He was livid at the Palestinian Authority as well, because he's lived outside of Gaza since 2005, since right 1 month before the Israeli disengagement. He went to study in the U.S. and then got refugee status there, but all of his family is in Gaza. And he's actually trying to get his brother out with his wife and 4 children. And he said the Palestinian Authority will take 2 to 3 months to get them passports. So he's furious at everyone. And he's furious in general of the narratives that Palestinian leaders have told the Palestinian people for the past 8 decades. It's been under different iterations. You know, at some point it was the PLO, and then there was the Marxists, the Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine, and then it was Hamas, which is an Islam movement. But the narrative has always been the same. And it's that we're going to liberate all of Palestine at some point. You know, Israel is just a temporary phenomenon. And we're not responsible for any of our actions. We're always the victims of history. And he's like, enough, halas, with all of this narrative, you know, because we keep making the same bad choices over and over. And he's saying, I cannot understand how people don't see the stupidity in what Hamas did on October 7th. How do people not expect the consequences of the Israeli reaction? And it's like, why don't we try something different for once? You know, peace has become a dirty word in the Palestinian peace camp, if there's such a thing, as it has become in Israel after, you know, the second intifada and the collapse of the Oslo peace agreement. Both sides are very disillusioned. But also saying that the Palestinian, you know, peace camp has always had this tendency of tolerating extremists like Hamas and of blaming Israel for everything. And it's time that we take responsibility for our own actions and we come up with a clear and pragmatic, I think that's a key word in all of his vision. We have to be pragmatic. We have to recognize that Israel is here to stay. There's no point in telling ourselves that we're going to liberate Palestine, all of historic Palestine, you know, including Haifa and Jaffa. This is never going to happen. We might as well accept that, you know, the Palestinian state, if it's going to be created one day, is going to be the West Bank and Gaza. And we have to live with Israel. You know, we should go into a partnership instead of antagonizing the Israelis over and over and pretending that we can get rid of them.
And where is his platform? Who's listening to him? How many, really?
So it's very interesting because he's going around peace events. He's been very active on social media. He's been writing editorials, even for like big papers. He's going around peace conferences, but he's insisting this is a one-man show. He doesn't want to associate with any other group because he wants to be independent. He wants to be able to say whatever he wants to say. So he's basically using his social media accounts like Facebook, Twitter, and he's been very vocal both against Hamas and against what the IDF has been doing in Gaza. He's obviously very concerned about his family who are still living there. So he likes to be able to say whatever he thinks. But he's gaining following.
I think you wrote 30,000. Right? 30,000 on Twitter?
Yeah, about 30,000 on Twitter. But for instance, like, he's getting backlash from Al Jazeera, which I think is a good sign. You know, if Al Jazeera journalists are paying attention to you, it means that you're saying something.
Got it. All right. So we'll obviously have a link to that piece and all the others at the bottom of the podcast article. And thank you. Thank you, Tal. Thank you, Luca, for being with me on today's Daily Briefing. It's been good to talk to you.
Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you, Jessica.
Thanks to you, listeners, for being with us for today's Daily Briefing. Stay tuned for tomorrow's installment. This episode was produced by the Podwaves. If you have comments about this or any other episodes, always feel free to drop us a line, podcast@timesvisual.com. Until next time, take care, Shabbat Shalom, hoping for a quiet day.